Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I'm thrilled to be speaking with the novelist, journalist, and women's rights activist Mary Anna Barbie. Mary Anna is a Vassar alumna and has lived in Switzerland for over 60 years now. She has published 12 books in French, and we're going to be talking in particular about Mary Anna's translation of one of her own books, her novel Prosperity Mill, which is about a textile mill strike in her native North Carolina. We'll also be talking about Mary Anna's life as a journalist and novelist in Switzerland since she left Vassar. Welcome, Mary Anna.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's really a delight to have you here. Often when we talk to alums on the program, I ask about their experience here of Vassar, since it's a perfect opportunity to trace if and how that experience as a student has figured in their subsequent careers and lives. Our audience consists partly of students, of course. And also, we learned something about the institution during the time that you were here. So I wonder, can you tell us about Vassar, you know, how you came to be here and what it was like?
Yes, of course. It's a long time ago.
How long ago? This is the 1950s, right? End of the 50s.
I enrolled in the class of 58. But I actually graduated in 73, I think, or 4, I can't remember. Well, it's a long story, but I left in my senior year to be married to my Swiss husband, and we were planning to come back for me to finish up my BA, and then we didn't. And you had to be a resident in those days. So it was very complicated, but eventually this residency requirement was lifted and I could finish up at Vassar with a BA later on. So I actually only spent 3 years, six semesters at Vassar. And it was a mixed experience. I feel deeply indebted to the professors, especially the Professor Vernon Venable, who was the head of the philosophy department and a wonderful teacher. And also the courses in history of art, which, as you can imagine, have served me well. I still remember visiting the south of France at one point, very young, with my husband, and telling him, oh, we could go to Saint-Gilles and see the bas-relief of Yves. And he looked at me and said, how did you know that? And there have been many, many examples of that. So these two areas were very, very important.
So you had Art 105 then?
Yes,
and
medieval art.
We still have Art 105, team taught by the whole department. It's a wonderful course.
I hope they've renewed the slides.
We have digital images now. First time we fired up that projector, Karen Lusick, our Americanist, put on Church's Niagara that took up the whole screen, 60 feet across and I think 25 feet high. So it was really something. So you felt compelled then to come back and finish your degree. You wanted that degree in the 1970s.
Oh, definitely. I always had a feeling of unfinished business. I had never planned on an academic career, but when I start something, I usually finish it. Yes, I was unhappy with the fact that I had no qualifications, even though a philosophy degree was not of any use. I remember discussing the possibility of a job with someone in France who said to me, Mademoiselle Pope, you have a remarkable record academically, but what do you know how to do? and he was quite right. I didn't know how to do anything. So I did. I knew how to get married. And that was pretty much what we did in those days.
This was very early, the 50s.
Without
for sure.
thinking beyond, really. And most of my friends in college were planning on marrying when they left college. And this was what we did, which sounds terribly silly now, but that's the way it was. Now, just another word on Vassar at the time. When I said it was a mixed experience, I think I could say it was very unhappy because I wasn't popular with lots of quotes around it. And I wasn't beautiful, and there was that awful thing called the daisy chain. Do you know about the daisy chain?
At graduation, yes.
Well, they chose the most beautiful girls in the class.
Well, not anymore, so.
I hope not. And, of course, most of the women were going off to Yale and Harvard for weekends, and I didn't do that. And it was difficult. It was
Yeah.
really difficult. I felt very much sort of a wallflower, you know. And then, in addition, something I read that you had written about, I was a very good student. For me, this had nothing to do with relationships and friendships. But I wonder now if it didn't have something to do with it, because one of my very good college friends, a late friend of the last year and a half, said to me one day, much later, "I was so amazed to discover that you were both one of the best students in our class and also a nice person." And I thought, well, yeah, maybe that explains things.
Yeah, that's interesting. So there was some resentment about the fact that you were a bright student among your fellow students.
Well, you know, I can't confirm that,
Yeah,
obviously, but I've realized that in later life. And I realized that envy and jealousy play a role in a lot of situations. And on the other hand, when you are in the top of the class, if I may say that in all modesty, well, it's pretty lonely. I mean, you're up there and you're doing what you like to do, what you know how to do. You're not stepping on anybody's toes. And certainly I was not somebody for competition, but I was just there doing my job. But in later life, I realized in similar situations or professional situations that this could, let's say it differently, you have to compensate for that by being a nice person.
I wonder, did the fact that your father was a trustee of the college have anything to do with the resentment that may have been there? Because he was trustee while you were a student, right?
Yes, which is probably why I came to Vassar, because he insisted and there was no reason not to. Although later I thought it would have been better for me to be in a co-ed college, but so it was. I'm
Interesting.
surprised I didn't rebel, actually. But I don't think it made much of a difference. I don't think this was a social class thing. You know, you never know what goes on in other people's minds. That was not really an issue for me. I mean, I never appealed to my father for anything during the time I was there, and I worked the whole time in the bookshop, making my own extra money. I mean, they paid for my tuition, obviously, but it was a burden for me.
So, how did you come to choose philosophy?
Well, I started out in religion, actually. My father was a theologian. He was dean of the Yale Divinity School. He was more the social action Christian side of Christianity. He was not a pious person, but I had been brought up in that, and it was important to me at the time. But I was bored. There were one or two courses in ethics in particular, which I enjoyed, but I was bored. I needed intellectual stimulation. And I took the basic course in philosophy, which was probably 105. And I thought, this is better for me. And I think I've always been somebody who was trying to figure things out, even as an adolescent, a young adolescent, for various reasons that Dr. Freud would probably bring to the light.
Well, yeah, with your father as an example there, as an academic, right? And then he's interested in labor questions. His
Yes.
book is about the labor movement and religion, so.
Millhands and Preachers is the title. I had never read it until the age of 60 some, because at that particular point, maybe I'm jumping ahead now, but we'll see. I discovered almost by chance that his archives had been saved when he went off to Norway with his second wife. My mother died, and he married again a Norwegian. And when he went to Norway, his archives, his papers and books were saved in the Yale Library, and there's a whole section on that. And so at one point I thought, maybe I should go and take a look. And then I discovered that there were the notes for his PhD thesis, which later became the book, Millhands and Preachers. And well, to make a very long story short, this is what led me to write a novel using the subject of his PhD thesis.
Before we go into Prosperity Mill, I wonder if we could talk about your life after Vassar. What took you to Switzerland, and how did you happen to become an expatriate?
Well, again, in sophomore year at Vassar, I was not very happy and I was bored intellectually and I needed a change. And there, my father really did come into place, to so to speak. And he suggested I take a semester off and go to the Ecumenical Institute near Geneva as an au pair girl, basically. Well, a maid, basically. There was a team of girls from all over Europe, no Americans, who did the housework and the dishes and all that. So I had spent the winter of 56, 57 near Geneva at the Ecumenical Institute. We spoke mostly English. There were a lot of Dutch and German girls who spoke some German, which I didn't understand, but I did work on my French somewhat. And I just loved the place. I felt like I'd come home. There was something about the atmosphere. Then there wasn't all the competition. There wasn't all the fur coats that there were at Vassar at the time, and the Yaleys and all that stuff. And I really felt that it had freed me from all that pressure. But since I didn't know how to do anything except a bit of housework now, I had to go back to Vassar, obviously. So I spent the second semester of my sophomore year in Switzerland. And then junior year, that's when I began the philosophy courses and worked hard that year, but I was really missing Switzerland. And then that summer, my father was host at the Yale Divinity School for the Central Committee of the World Council of Churches, of which he was an executive member. And I needed a summer job, and he said I could work in the office and do some stuff, welcoming people and the paperwork and so on, which I did. And Clément, my future husband, was there to translate, and he was bored. There was a lot of boredom in my history. He was bored because nobody needed a translator. They all spoke English that particular summer.
Boredom is a French virtue, however, isn't it? So it seems to be so. Ennui, so yeah.
So he would come over to the house in the evening for a beer because there wasn't any bistro around the Yale Divinity School. And we fell in love, and it was really a coup de foudre, love at first sight, more or less. I mean, very quick. So that's how I ended up in Switzerland.
Oh, wonderful. What a great story. So you lived as a housewife for some time in Switzerland. Yes, but you also developed a career eventually as a journalist.
No, it's more complicated than that because my life has been sort of a zigzag. Well, I had a few children, and I tried hard to be a good pastor's wife, but because Clément was also a minister, a Protestant minister, we went to France, lived in France for 3 years in La France profonde, and that was a bit hard. But it was also the time when my two eldest children were born in France. And then we came back to Switzerland and had a parish. And again, I tried really hard to be a good pastor's wife, but I was feeling all along that it wasn't really my thing. So whenever the opportunity arose, I did something else. I was fortunate to have an au pair girl because we had huge houses at the time, you know, the presbytère. What do you call that in English? When there's a special house for the minister.
The rectory.
We had big houses, and of course there I did have some duties, so we were lucky to have some help. So I took a couple of courses in journalism, and I got active in on a local committee for family planning of the churches. So this was always in the context of the church. And one thing led to another. Then I trained as a family planning counselor. There was a special program for family planning counselors and sex education teachers. I got involved with the local Department of Public Health because they had a lot of documentation for these questions, family planning, but nobody knew anything about it at the time. But there was a big stack of documents in English. And one day I picked up my phone and I called the director of the public health department, and it said, "Do you need somebody to classify your documents and perhaps use them one way or another or set up a library?" So that's here we are. We
So
come to libraries,
libraries, yes.
Thomas.
Yeah, very interesting.
I
Well, that's
started out
wonderful.
as a
Yeah,
librarian
librarian. That's interesting.
at 7 francs an hour. I was paid, but you know, I got my foot in the door basically because I didn't have anything that qualified me for anything. I wasn't a psychologist, I wasn't a sociologist, I wasn't a teacher. So that's how I got my foot in the door. And then I was in charge of the very small activity in the media for these. They were hot subjects, if I can say that that way. So we were in demand quite frequently, and they needed somebody who was capable of talking to the media, going on the radio, writing blurbs, and so on, which I did. And that's how I became a journalist.
Still in the
But I should
content.
say just one thing. When I was 13 at high school, I took a thing for, the orienting children toward the profession. What's it called?
Oh, aptitude test, that
So
was it.
when I was 13, and it was a test, and I came out even on social work and journalism. So it was already there. I mean, there was, I was, it was there. And I've been fortunate to do both. I mean, working in psychosocial fields like sex education and family planning, and all the writing workshops and so on.
So you were working as a journalist, writing articles and having them published then, but you also then had a radio audience, so you were doing radio.
Yes, I worked with a professional radio journalist. It was an afternoon program, and it was one of the very first, perhaps even the first program on the Swiss French-speaking radio that used the telephone and asked people to phone in.
Oh, it's a talk
So we
show.
chose a subject every week, and they were usually hot subjects again. And the people phoned in and asked their questions. And then we also allowed other people to phone in and say what their solution would have been or how they felt about it. And then there were one or two so-called experts in the studio. And we, sort of kept things calm because it got very excited sometimes. We got a lot of threats and threats of legal proceedings. And people later, a bit later, when I was working in the written press, I occasionally got threats over the phone and that sort of thing. So it was pretty exciting, pretty exciting. But it was a good time because things were opening up. It wasn't like it is now, when everything seems to be closing down. Everything was opening up. We were in the aftermath of the 60s, the 70s, where people were willing to think about difficult subjects and open up. And so it was a good time to be doing all
Yeah,
that.
women's rights was really taking off in France as well as the United States, wasn't it, at this
Well,
period?
I
So,
was never very much involved in the women's rights movement because I would have, at that time, if I had voted, for instance, in the Swiss elections, I would have lost my American nationality.
That's
So,
interesting.
at that point, I wanted to keep my dual nationality. And then there were plenty of other women very active in women's rights. As you probably know, Switzerland was one of the last European countries to give the right to vote to women because the population had to vote on it. And of course, the population that voted was the
Was a big
men.
man, yeah.
So it was it took a
Suffrage,
long, long time. You had to have a majority of the cantons as well as the popular vote. So it took a long time for the population to be mature enough to the male population to be mature enough to give the women the right to vote. There were a lot of women who were very active in that field, and they didn't need me.
So then, how did you become a novelist and go into creative writing from journalism? What spurred you?
Well, at one point in the late 70s, I began to think, am I really going to spend my whole career, my working life, basically listening to other people's sexual problems and and social problems? And also, I was working in the media on these subjects, and I got really quite a lot of criticism, we'll call it, to stay polite, from the authorities in the institution I was working for. I mean, they didn't like it at all that I was writing in the newspaper at the same time I was working for them because they were worried that this was going to affect their budget and their financing and so on. I mean, and it was really very, very tense. So I began to sort of look around and think, well, what do I actually want to do with my life? And I'd
Does
always
it?
been troubled by the fact that my children in school, they went through the usual schools in Switzerland, public schools. We're not getting any training at all in writing, which I thought was a pity. And I had, on several occasions, I'd been called on to help colleagues to write stuff because they didn't have any training either. So at one point, I began thinking about that and then went to take a week workshop in France with the woman who began the writing workshops in France. And I thought, well, I can do this. I've trained in group leading groups, and I'm trained in individual counseling, so that side of it shouldn't be a problem. I'm not well trained in French literature, but I can do something about that. That's not so difficult. And actually, that was, I'd say, more a help than a hindrance, because I was not influenced by Balzac or Camus. I'd read some of them, of course, I'd read Camus, but I was not under the influence the way a French person would have possibly have been, and surely the person I trained with was. But I think it was a good thing. I was learning alongside my participants. And so then, after giving it a lot of thought and doing a lot of reading, I set up the first writing workshop in French-speaking Switzerland. I was really the pioneer there. There were some workshops in German-speaking Switzerland, but not in our area at all. Nobody knew what it was. I had to explain. There was a local popular education program. Then they agreed to take me on, but they couldn't figure out why I needed 3 hours with these people. Well, you just go in and you give your course, your lecture, and then you go out and you give them homework if they have to do some writing themselves. So it was a totally different mindset, a totally different method. And so there again, one thing led to another. And my first book was a journalist's book, basically, but about my experiences in family planning and sex education. It was a very personal book. It's a memoir, which sort of covers the various aspects of those activities. And it was a big success. So I thought, well, let's carry on. And that's how I got into writing. But my first novel was more of a challenge. I just thought, well, can I write a novel? Let's try. It's a novel which is no longer in print, called D'Amérique, which is the only piece of writing that I got a prize for, but unfortunately it's no longer in print.
So you do have a range of novels that you published over time, besides Prosperity Mill, we're going to talk about. I know you're working on a translation of another novel, Les Amants du Bois Sacré, Dreamers of the Sacred Wood. Hopefully we can talk about that at a future date. But then you've got a crime novel, you've had an actual bestseller, so you've tried your hand at various genres in a sense, yes? So I don't know what my question here is, but well, you're writing in French, not your native language, of course. So how does that affect what comes out?
Well, usually it's not a question, it's a surprise for most people. But I was living in French. I was thinking in French. My children speak French. They speak English a bit, but they're not native English speaking at all. And then eventually, with my husband, we were both bilingual, but we spoke French in the end because the children couldn't figure out what we were
What we're saying
talking
in
about
English,
when they were very small. And this was my life. My life was in French. And I was determined when I got here to lose my accent and to be competent in every way possible. So I never, for instance, I never learned German properly. I can understand a little bit, but really, I can just barely go shopping. And I never learned another language. I really decided I'm going to do this French thing the very best I can. And at the time, also the late 50s, when I came here to Switzerland, it was not really good to be an American. Americans were loud, they had plenty of money, they threw it around, they were not popular. And I needed to disguise myself. There was also a problem with my in-laws. I was not really accepted. And so I felt I really had to, turn into a chameleon. And a lot of people had never even realized that I have a different origin. I'm totally Frenchicized now. Well, Switzerland, not France, but
Interesting. So then, if French literature doesn't influence you, do you have other influences in your writing? I suppose I don't know if you've ever thought about it. I'm thinking, of course, Faulkner, Flannery O'Connor. You've got that whole Southern thing behind you. Although you're not really entirely a Southerner either.
Not really. I mean, I've been influenced by some of the thinkers like Roland Barthes in France. And because it wasn't my native language, when I started out, I had to keep it simple. So Camus was important because his writing is very economical. So that and Barthes, with his degree zero of literature, they authorized me to do less.
That's wonderful because it comes through in this book for sure, in a really good way. I mean, you seem to have mastered that
Oh,
style.
thank
I
you.
thought Camus immediately when I started reading
Thank
it.
you. It's very flattering.
And then the other influence here for me is philosophy, of course.
Yes.
I can feel that in it. And then we didn't talk about that, but when you did decide to finally finish your bachelor degree, you took philosophy classes in Geneva, a class at least, to finish up, and then you worked on a sort of master's thesis on Marcuse, was it?
Well, it was just a senior thesis, but it was 150 pages long
Well, that's a long senior thesis, yeah.
because I felt, well, the two courses in Geneva were interesting, but they were, I just went and listened. I didn't participate in anything, and we didn't have papers to do. They were fillers to give me my credits. So I felt I really had to do a very good job on my senior thesis, which Vassar allowed me to do for them, the philosophy department. And that really was the high point, I think, of my career at Vassar. It was
Interesting,
doing
yeah.
that. I did it. I wrote it here, obviously, but I went to Vassar to negotiate the calendar and how we were going to work on it. And then I received my degree,
Cum
and
laude,
I was
right?
so
Yes,
proud. I was
yeah.
so proud to
Yeah.
have done that. And then, in addition, I found Marcuse's work really fascinating, so and very pertinent with respect to what I was doing out in the field with sex
Sex
education and family.
education, sure. In those years, everybody was reading him. I was reading him. The spotlight was really on him, certainly in the early 70s, late 60s.
Well, it's been very, very useful for me as well in terms of understanding what I was trying to do in the field.
So let's talk about Prosperity Mill. If it isn't strictly autobiographical, it seems to map onto your life insofar as it traces an attempt by an older woman who was born in this mill town in North Carolina to come to terms with a traumatic historical moment in that town, which was a deadly strike that occurred during her childhood, after living away from that town most of her life. So your protagonist, whose name is Susanna Marshall, is a renowned historian. You make her into an historian, which is interesting. And I'm guessing you weren't, as a child, directly caught up, either through your father and mother, in the events of that strike, as Susanna was. But I wonder if you can talk about the novel sort of generally and how it ties into your life. You've done that a bit. It has to do with your father's interest. But also, Susanna has been living away from this town all her life, and she comes back to visit it. I don't know if she's been living in Europe. Maybe not, but the town seems so foreign to her in a strange way. The eatery there, called the Graduate, I think it is. Maybe it's just because the town is so far back in her past, it seems like foreign country is up. Who was it that said the past is a foreign country? Am I mistaken about Susanna? Is she not coming from Europe? Am I just sort of aligning your life onto her life there? So somebody going back anyway and looking at her origin, so.
Well, Susanna is, of course, she's somewhat like me, but again, she isn't. I mean, it really is a work of fiction. And I got into it when it's almost like a mistake, because when I read my father's thesis, finally, at the age of 60 some, and his notes that were still there in his archive, I thought, well, this is a great subject. Two people were killed during the strike. The strike took place in Gastonia in North Carolina. And I thought, this is an obscure subject, but it's really interesting. And why not write about it, use it for the background of a novel? For my own readership here in Switzerland, I wasn't aiming at anything else. But then I discovered that there had been half a dozen novels that had already treated the subject, so it was not exactly a scoop. And even now, there's somebody who's just published a novel on the subject who won a prize, actually. So I missed my goal with that in that respect. I wasn't dragging up something. I wasn't, reviving something that everybody'd forgotten. Not at all. But it's still a great subject because it's the whole question of the labor movement and workers' rights. But the strike was led by the communists. But what is more autobiographical in the book itself is is Susanna's parents. Her father works at the mill as an accountant, and he's very much on the side of the bosses. And her mother teaches in the mill village and gets involved with the communists and is very idealistic. And I think that pretty much sums up my own parents, with my father, who was a very well-known authoritative person. He wasn't in on the side of the bosses. That's not what I'm saying. at all. In fact, he was very committed to civil rights and was is well known for that and integration, racial integration. He's still well known for that.
I saw a photograph of him standing next to Martin Luther
The
King,
Martin
actually,
Luther
you know, so
King.
yeah, so yeah.
Yeah, no, he had his day. And my mother was a very quiet person, a Southern belle, and still very much attached to her Southern roots, but probably a freer person than my father, and personally. I mean, it's a, anyway, I thought it was interesting to show Susanna caught between these two parents. And she was only 14 at the time of the strike and sort of having to cope with the events, the violent events. And she retained a feeling of fear, sort of a fearful character for a very long time. And I finally decided that if she went back to Gastonia, it was also to try to conquer that. This is not the main point of the novel either. She does go back because there's another academic who has questioned her theories, her vision, and her historical vision of the events. And she thinks she's still missing something that she hasn't. But in fact, she's missing a key to her own history and not to the history of the strike.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about it for me is that, well, it's a very philosophical novel, as I said, it's very spare. So you feel that you're working with ideas right through it, and you're working with history too. But she has this drive to overcome an error that she feels may be there. So it's a question. There's a question that has to be answered for her, but this has to do with her own life. And then the way you set it up from the very beginning, you're in this world that's sort of in the past, but it's in the present that she's in, and you really do that wonderfully. And I wonder, sometimes it's great if we can get someone to read, you know, from their novel. So I don't know if you'd want to read the prologue that set the whole thing up for me just in those few paragraphs. I thought it was wonderful, and it would set the audience up here too, in a way, to look forward into the novel if they're interested in getting the novel. So they don't feel like they don't need to, you know, read the novel, you know, from our listening to our talk here. So.
I'm not a very good reader, and my voice is scratchy right now. It's been so very dry here, the way it's been everywhere. So my vocal cords are not in very good shape, but I can certainly try. I really appreciate what you say about the writing because it was difficult to combine the story in the past and the story in the present.
No, it
And
works. It
to keep
works.
it a story, I mean, you're right. There are lots of thoughts in this book, but
It's a
it's the
fill
story
it
of people, basically. And
yeah.
people's stories have been my life, even in family planning.
Yeah.
So it's not a philosophical treatise. Okay, well, let's go. Carolina in the morning, humming under my breath, watching the taxi dissolve in the distance. Bad eyesight, of course, but then everything seemed to dissolve now. God, love, great causes, small miseries, even children, all so evanescent. Trailing behind you like a comet's tail, ice and dust, particles suspended in outer space, that other life before old age. But here I was still, an ancient body standing straight on a Carolina sidewalk, my old mohair cardigan pulled tight across my grandma's breasts. The sun on my back, soft, almost warm on this April morning. Nevertheless, I felt the cold. My shadow lay stretched out in front of me as I hesitated, an indefinite shape, pointing the way to the house across the road, the old house. It hadn't changed much, yellow brick and white trim, the way I remembered it. The paint was peeling, the magnolia was gone, and the pine tree had grown tall, almost to the roof. Did it matter? As a child, I'd never noticed these things anyway. Most of the time, I was indoors studying or at school or swimming in the Catawba with Jane and Mickey. Now I'd come back, a homecoming, but with no welcoming committee. Nobody remembered Susanna Louise Marshall. Nobody would write a blurb in the local paper. Professor Marshall, the textile industry's famous historian, returns to her native town. Nearing 80, she, if the truth be told, nobody cared. Famous historian, where did that come from? A very ordinary scholar, they should say. To be sure, I devoted my life to studying the forces at work in the Southern industry. But now I simply wanted to be able to tell it all one last time to some sympathetic ear. My own version, down to the most minute details. The Great War, the strikes, the Depression, the battles in far-off France and Flanders, which brought prosperity to the South, the cotton bales and the yards of fabric, the uniforms and the bandages, soaking up the blood in the trenches, not to mention the workers' joy, happy to do their bit, while, of course, sharing in North Carolina's economic boom. There was a woman, Rose something, on television not long ago, even more ancient than I am. She'd been a weaver right here at Prosperity Mill. White hair, pink cheeks, but her voice was frail as she filled the screen with her memories. Those were the best years, she said. The best years, you know. The mill was like an ocean liner, especially at night when all the lights were on. And the music, you should have heard the music of those great machines. Yes, the music. She was right. Those were good years during the Great War. Enough?
Quite beautiful. So it does give you a sense of what the novel is going to be about.
Definitely.
And about her need to tell somebody her story, which is what history is, isn't it? We have this need to tell stories about what actually has happened to us, translating this experience that the town had and that she's had also into some kind of a truth. There is a truth here to be had. And that's what makes it philosophical, the search for the truth, I think. And then the way you set it up, structurally, you have these places. She's working in a library, isn't she? And you
Yes.
have these places in the library. She has the reading room with the table where her friend that she develops, who works in the library, talks with her. And then they go down into the staff room downstairs to have coffee. And so you've got these stage settings. You could almost easily translate it to drama quite nicely, I think, which adds to the simplicity of it and the sort of philosophical air that we're working with ideas. For me, anyway, that's how it affects me. So did you have trouble figuring out how you were going to stage the thing or set the thing, which is important because settings are difficult, I know, when you're writing.
It was very difficult, and because there were two time frames, obviously, and some of the people I gave the manuscript to sort of early on, they said it's too confusing. You've got two things going on at once, and you've got to do something about it. And I replied, yes, but if I don't have the two things, I don't have a book. This is the whole point. But obviously, I had to work on it to make sure that it would be okay. So I'm always pleased when somebody says it does work. There were various problems. The first problem was I went to Gastonia, of course, and I worked a bit in the library. Well, I worked in the library at Gastonia, and they were very helpful. There aren't an awful lot of documents still. There wasn't anything. There was microfilm, which was very interesting for the newspapers. But otherwise, there wasn't really much to discover. But Gastonia was, I never got the feel of the place. It was just an ordinary southern town, but there was nothing special. So I had to find something else. And so I thought, well, I'll just use what I have. It's a library. I worked in a library. It's not exactly the same library, obviously, and the people aren't the same, but why not? I mean, this was all I could think to use.
No, it's perfect.
And the other problem was, what tense was I going to write this in? So I don't know if you noticed, but the part that happens in the library, which is Susanna's present day visit at the age of nearly 80, is all in the past, written in the past. And when she tells the story, I use different typesetting and tell it as directly as a story that's unfolding on the page in the present. So the past is written in the present, and the present is written
in the
past.
Yeah, interesting. And the past is written through her talking to her friend Olivia about what happened. Then what
but it's
happened
not
happens.
Quoted.
Yeah, it's not quoted, no. So it works perfectly. What I love it, well, I'm a librarian, of course, so the fact that it takes place in the library is important. And it captures the mystery of the library and the mystery of looking for the answers to mysteries in the library. And then the library is set in your introduction in the prologue here. This is a mysterious scene where she is going back into her own past and experiencing what she experienced as a child. So she's not entirely in the present, but she's not in the past either. She's on this borderline, in a sense, between the past and the present, which makes it, for me, philosophical. It's mental to a great extent, it's conceptual. And then the library is the same kind of a space, so the transition between the two is wonderful. And then the whole novel really transpires, I think, in this space to some extent, in the telling of a story. So it's really a beautiful thing conceptually.
Thank you.
Worth a read just for someone interested in structuring fiction, honestly. It's very creative. And I wondered if that comes out of your workshops. I mean, do you talk about these things in your writing workshops? Because I get the sense that there's a conscious writer here that really knows what she's doing. It's very creative, but it's also very thought through, it seemed to me. That's all.
Well, again, I'm a philosopher. I don't think I'm a novelist. My sister is a novelist, and I can see the difference. I'm not somebody dreaming up stories, from morning to night. I'm a fairly realistic person. I've been very active, and I think your description is perfectly true to form accurate. Yes, I learned a lot with my students, and I also did a lot of reading about how to write. But I felt I needed a certain number of tools and concepts to be able to do it because it's not natural for me. And especially anything to do with space. I'm not a visual person. So anything to do with space and settings, physical settings, description, it's awful. I hate doing that. So I really have to work at it. And I'm always amazed when someone tells me that it actually works because I've put in a lot of labor, but sometimes when there's too much labor, it doesn't work. So your kind words are, a balm.
Well, Sartre and Camus and Simone de Beauvoir would all say the same thing. I'm not a novelist, I'm a philosopher,
Well, I'm good then. They were certainly all the thing when I was studying philosophy back at Vassar. It was existentialism.
Well, she
Although one
was.
of my philosophy professors commented on one of my papers on Kierkegaard. He called it the exegesis of a groan. So the professors were not particularly keen on existentialism. That was what was on.
So the friend Suzanne meets, Olivia, she's an interesting character and an important part of this, and an important part that makes it into a philosophical scene, and that it makes it into a kind of Phaedrus, doesn't it? There's a dialogue that takes place. And to some extent, it isn't strict philosophical dialogue, but Susanna is teaching Olivia about the past in a way, and Olivia is teaching her also, and in some sense, in the library setting. So who is Olivia, and why do you have her here, and why this difference between the generations also? She does come from a different world. She comes from the present, in a sense, so very much so. She's very with it. She's got her tattoos, and
No, I don't think so.
well, maybe not.
Did
I
you
picture
see
her
a
with tattoos. I
tattoo?
did see a
She
tattoo.
would
Yeah,
know. She
she would
would
know.
know.
Would know. Yeah. So
I was this was written originally almost 20 years
Yeah,
ago.
it's funny the things that you invent yourself when you're reading. I have to go back and look.
I know, but this is, every writer knows that readers see a lot of stuff that we didn't actually
that you
do.
put there. There's this difference in age, and she does play this interesting role as the person that Susanna can tell her story to, and then through which she brings the past up. Her own memory comes through her telling of Olivia what happened.
Well, I can remember very clearly I was writing Prosperity Mill, working on it, and I was in the middle of a workshop and the people were writing and I was in my room doing something else and thinking about Prosperity Mill. And I suddenly realized that in none of the books that I had published so far or written so far, I had characters who had children. And I thought, this is like a Freudian slip. I mean, this is something weird in my work as a writer. I've never had a character who had a child or have even spoken about my own children. Well, that's a different question, but anyway. And I had this sort of feeling, I have to do something about that. I have to give something more complete in the life of my character, Susanna. And so I figured she had to have children, but then I thought, Probably given who she was, it would be difficult with her own children, which it is in the book. And so I invented Olivia, who to start out looked a bit like one of my nieces that I'm very fond of. We always use models and experiences within our own lives. And Olivia is sort of one step removed. She's not Susanna's daughter. She's somebody she's just met. She's an intern at the library. She's a young woman. And she has her own problems. But this did eventually become a theme, which is really very, very important for me, especially now as I've become a very old lady. It's the, how do you transmit? How do you pass things on? How do you tell stories? What are our children going to remember of what we've done? And will they understand why we've done it? And they're often, they reject a lot. And I don't know if you have children, but mine tend to reject a lot of the things that I stand for.
I wonder if all historians think this way, and that Susanna is a historian, and your audience is going to be people in the future, who are young now, so I don't know.
Well, and also, as there's a passage in the book where Susanna is sitting in the vacant lot where the strikers had set up their tent colony. And it's a passage that gave me a lot of hard work, trouble, but which I really like because I think it's sort of a core of the book. And she realizes that when she dies, the only thing that will be left is a bunch of documents and microfilms and perhaps her own thesis. But it's not alive, it's stuff on shelves. I didn't say it exactly that way. And this is something that as we grow very old, I'm 86, is very, very present. I mean, there are so many things that nobody else knows and that are going to disappear with us. I've felt this perhaps particularly strongly because I've been living all my life away from my family and the people I grew up with. And also, my husband died when I was 45. So I have no one to share. My sister is much, much younger than I am. She's 15 years younger. So I have no one with whom to share the things of my earlier life. And this is perhaps also why I need to write, give things. Well, of course, you write also because you want to give form and structure to the chaos of your life. But I think these are important things to think about as we grow older. Who's going to carry on what we've tried to do? And just a parenthesis, but recently, in recent days, I've been very, very angry. I'm really angry deep down inside because of Roe versus Wade, because I've spent my life working on these subjects and helping people. And it's so dreadful what's happening now.
It is.
And it's so wrong because this is not the way you do away with abortion. This is the wrong way to do it. And these people are stupid thinking that they're going to change something with their method.
No, I agree. And
And
they
this
believe,
is
of course,
also
they're
part
doing
of,
it in the name of religion also, which is
oh, well,
idiotic,
yes, I
it's
mean,
idiotic,
but this is also about, how do you transmit? And I never miss it an opportunity to tell people what I've observed and what I've been doing and what we've all been working for here. Switzerland has perhaps the lowest rate of abortion in the world. And that's because we've been working hard.
Wonderful. Maybe we should sometime in the future do a show on that, your
Well,
experience in
I'd love to
Switzerland
because
with
that
family
really is
planning. It
something
would be
important for
really
me.
useful. Okay. And some of your writing is about that. Some of your,
I've got two books that are more like memoirs, journalistic.
I will
One is
dive.
an essay on how we set up family planning
Yeah, in
in
my very slow
Switzerland.
French, I will get through those and get back to you then on them. That would be great. We could have you on periodically as a sort of foreign correspondent or guest,
Well, I'd be
I
happy
mean,
to do
if
it.
you're up to it. Okay, that's wonderful. So two questions, I guess. One has to do with translation. You're in a unique spot in that you're translating your own work, and so you can speak to a question that came up. Maybe it's more an interesting question than it would be something to answer. But if you were writing Prosperity Mill just in English, would it be a different book than this Prosperity Mill that you wrote in French and translated to English? Because you're the author of both the translation and the book, but it's washed through your French and the French language. I don't know if that makes sense, but it came to mind. Am I just reading a novel that was written in English? No, I'm not. I'm reading a translation. But it's a translation by the person who wrote the novel, who speaks English as well as French. So does that make sense as a question? I mean, what does translation add to the book? That's the question, I guess. Something to think about. Maybe it can't be answered. I don't know, but.
I don't know. I don't think, well, certainly Prosperity Mill would not be a different book. Maybe other books of mine, which are more personal, would be different in English, possibly. What we usually say is that your emotions are stronger or more accessible or come out more in your native language, but I'm not even sure that's true. I think sometimes I've had more freedom to express my emotions in French than I would have had in English. So it's, I don't know, I don't think it makes a big difference. What was nice about doing my own translation is that I could change a few things as I went along. I didn't do it much, but a little bit. But then, you know, what they say, Marguerite Yourcenar rewrote some of her books in, as she grew older, and she rewrote them completely. So I thought I was authorized to do that, and it was legitimate. And the other book you mentioned that I'm working on now, I really did change quite a few things or add things that I felt it was too sort of spare. I think the question is more general. Who would I have become as a writer if I had written in English to begin with? But of course, I can't answer that. I did my mystery detective story, which is called Swiss Traffic, was first written in English. And I sent it off to an agent in Britain who was very interested. I was all excited. And then he asked me my age. And when I told him I was a senior, I'd written it under a pseudonym. So he couldn't look me up on Google. He said, "Well, if you're a senior, we don't want you." Because, you
How
know,
awful.
It was terrible, but it was at the same time, it was very encouraging because he really liked the book. But then I decided to do it in French because my audience is here, my readership is here. As I went along doing it in French, of course, I changed the book completely. I wrote my I worked on the plot more, I changed the characters a bit. I mean, it was a different book altogether. Now I'm trying to translate it back into English, but that's complicated.
It is interesting. I suppose there are whole mindsets. There's a French mindset. You're thinking of your readers also, of course, and putting yourself in their place, and that they have a certain mindset. Some things are acceptable, some aren't culturally. So,
Well,
interesting.
that's why I'm so pleased that you actually enjoy Prosperity Mill, because I haven't had so far, I haven't had a lot of readers in English. And of course, this is a question one always asks oneself, is are the readers going to be very different because they are English speaking and not French or Latin types? But I felt that Prosperity Mill really had to exist in English because it takes place in North Carolina with a piece of history, of American history, which is important.
So we're just talking about memory, what you've thought about for a long time, and the reason we tell stories. And I wonder if you take any comfort that your work will survive you as a kind of monument of who you were. And I like to think that's one of the reasons we collect the writings of alumni here in the Vassar Library, that it places the best part of you in a way, the memory of what matters to you anyway, into the wider collective memory of the institution, which after all is a community of people living and no longer with us, and a culture. And of course this personal memorialization is a gesture toward historical meaning and revealed being, which seems to me can only be a good thing for all of us. So anyway, you were talking about the fact that these texts live on and we have to tell our stories, and this is one place we can find a story. So just to say, I'm really glad we can keep your archive here at Vassar, where it belongs.
Well, I'm very honored to think that my books, most of my books, are at Vassar. And no, I was saying to the man who shares my life today, my compagnon, the expression, "Nobody is a prophet in his own country." And here in Switzerland, I've done things that are so different. You mentioned it earlier, of the variety of things, that I'm what we call inclassable, that nobody knows sort of where to put me in the. And I've never really been considered a Swiss writer, although I'm writing here, publishing here, And so somehow the fact of your response, the fact my books are now at Vassar, I won't say it's like coming home, but it's very rewarding, very, very rewarding. And I feel I've gotten, I've also put out a few feelers in other places to try to promote the book. And the people who've actually looked at it have all been very positive. It's well, as I say, very, very rewarding.
Well, the problem with an audience with an Amazon publication is you have to do your own marketing, and that's impossible. And you realize the value of publishers then. It's like an artist thinking they can sell their paintings in the mall. It just doesn't work. You need a gallery, you know. You may have to pay the gallery 50% of what the painting sells for, but it's highly worth it to have somebody that knows something about marketing your work. So,
Well, yes and no. The Swiss publishing situation is very special because French-speaking Switzerland is a very small place. And so there's not a huge market for our books, and we always need special financing as a result. And I haven't been very happy with my publishers, because I felt the early publishers did a good job. But since then, they haven't been doing a very good job on the marketing. And I find it's been such a pleasure to see this book. Well, your listeners aren't able to see it, but
It's a beautiful book. The cover
the
design is
cover
wonderful.
was very well done, and the computer specialist who did the text did a wonderful job. So it's not an amateur book. I think it looks just as good as any published book. But of course, there is the problem of distribution. And so I hope some of your listeners will feel that they can put out the three or four, how much is it, dollars for a Kindle version. It's not very expensive.
And
And
I'd urge anyone who does read it to do an Amazon review because that does tick
oh,
it up.
please, yes, because
So
I know
it
that
helps.
helps a
Yeah, it
lot.
does. Yeah,
Yeah.
so.
But that's not why I did it. I did it really because I wanted the book to exist, and now it's in the Gastonia Library. The North Carolina librarians are going to do a review in their journal. So I've had a nice exchange with the person who's doing the review. And he mentioned the fact that it can be used in book clubs and in classrooms and as a group thing.
I can see it being used as a political science text, frankly, because it is a kind of little laboratory where you've got all the elements in there. You really analyze the sort of communist influence. You mentioned the anarchist influence in it, so just sorting out the two, and then you show what happens, and mostly the fact that a lot of these actions were perpetrated by women. I mean, it was women that carried this strike, completely forgotten to historians. And then, of course, you have a character who is a journalist in it, who is the one person who does record what's happened, a girl journalist in the 1920s.
1929.
Yeah, so,
Well,
but
all of this is true to the facts. I mean, that's one of the things the North Carolina librarian has underlined in his review. It's the fact that it really is a solid book in terms of the research and the facts. And so, yes, it can be used, but it's fiction, so
It's
you can
fiction,
also
yeah.
read it for
Read it that
pleasure,
way,
I hope.
Okay. So I'd like to thank you, Mariana, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your new translation of your book, Prosperity Mill. It's available by searching on that title in Amazon. And then you'll have to promise to come back to talk with us about your translation, upcoming translation of Les Amants du Bois Sacré or Dreamers of the Sacred Wood, once that's published. And then also maybe we can talk about your work in women's rights in Switzerland and reproductive rights and talk about your views about how things are going in the good old USA here. Okay, but anyway, it's wonderful to have you on the
It's a
show.
pleasure.
Mine too.